This week's episode is brought to you by Louise Harlow and Jessica Ferguson McClellan. Thank you, Louise Harlow and Jessica Ferguson McClellan. It's with the generous support of listeners like you that we at The Whole Rabbit get to keep farming golden carrots from the cavernous rabbit holes of perennial wisdom every week. If you'd like to become a supporter, you can get access to our exclusive library of extended episodes at www.patreon.com, where for $5, you'll not only get that, but a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art sent to you at no additional cost. But that's not all. You'll get a special link to our Discord server, where our network of spies coordinate to overthrow the global hegemony and establish the world's biggest drive-through movie theater for UFOs. Join today! This episode is part of an ongoing series. If you missed Thelema Without Cute Hats and Book of the Law, Chapter 1, Nuit, you might find this one a bit disorienting. If you'd like to ride the entire thought train, please begin there. In this week's episode, we discuss the meat and potatoes of the Book of the Law, the primary holy text of Aleister Crowley's Religion of Thelema, by diving into Chapter 2, which is spoken in the voice of the primordial point, Hadit, who is light, consciousness, and, everywhere, the center. For those with only a tangential interest in Thelema, we might consider Hadit equivalent to Anatman of Buddhism, Atman of the Sudarshana Dharma, and even the Black Flame of the Left-Hand Path. We sincerely hope this provides you with something tasty for your brain to chew on. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Computer f***ing blue screened.
Got the BSOD.
Blue screen of resurrection, come on.
There is no death.
You can die for 3 minutes, you must come back.
Lots of little electrical glitches and mishaps while studying this chapter.
It's all the stuff inside the circle.
Blowing out circuits.
Hello everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just study Liber Al Legis for indisputable proof that Finding Nemo is satanic propaganda designed to lure the innocent into drinking from the wrath of Babylon's fornication so they get abducted by dentists from a higher dimension. Nay, we delicately unravel each line from the Book of the Law like a nervous date on prom night as we piece by piece get closer to the naked expression of the mystic truths, which continue to work even when Dad's not home and the lights are off, because this week we're discussing Book 2 of the Book of the Law. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the Cosmic Ocean of Corgi, Mari Sama. The Builder of Nuts and Buster of Black Lodges, Malachor 5.
Hello.
And the Cream Peepers of the Midnight Womb, Heka Astra.
Hello. It's just calamine lotion.
It puts the lotion on the eyelids.
She's got the goopy gaze. Yeah, why do you have a bunch of cream on your eyes?
I wore makeup and I had an allergic reaction to the eyeshadow. And I don't normally wear makeup, so I guess I'm just allergic to something in it. So I have a rash on my eyelids. And I slathered calamine lotion on my eyelids now.
It's what they call moisturizing.
I see what you did there.
The Book of the Law is cool for the same reason Kubrick's The Shining is cool. It's kind of dreamy, sporadically dark, and incomprehensible if you're looking at it from the surface level. But once you begin reading into the metaphors and symbolism, it does the same thing those weird 90s era 3D cross your eyes puzzles things do, and it's just about as easy to show your friends.
I remember those.
A schooner is a sailboat, dumb head.
They were called Magic Eye.
The Book of the Law is a little bit like that. You first show it to somebody and they're like, that's not a boat.
I guess no one got the Mallrats reference.
Let's put it this way. Reading the Book of the Law properly is like listening to the lyrics of a good hip-hop album. It won't make any sense if you read it 100% literally. Often phrases have deeper, double, and even triple meanings. They may refer to other material the audience is expected to be or become familiar with, and the effect feels equally as poignant and personal. It's kind of like the Bible Part 2, but in slam poetry version.
So for anyone that missed the extended show from the Thelema episode, I guess we'll just do a quick recap to bring you up to speed on who is Hadit, because the second chapter of the Book of the Law is spoken by Hadit. So Hadit could be described as consciousness, life, or awareness. We have Nuit, who's infinite expansion, and Hadit is contraction. He's the individual reality or expression of Nuit. We know we're all subject to individual perspectives of reality, manifest as personal awareness or consciousness. So Nui is the infinite circle and Hadi is the point in that circle manifest as the principle of consciousness. He's the lover of Nuit, and in Thelema, he's the divine masculine principle, described as being the point in the circle, the serpent, the diameter of the circle, or the axle of the wheel. So he's the masculine principle made whole with Nuit, and because Hadit is Nuit manifested, he can be seen as all the starlight of the cosmos or stars within the body of Nuit. And Hadit is related to all stars and all life manifest.
And the sun, right?
He's like your magic daddy in his man cave with all his stuff, all his trophies and baseball cards. He's got it all.
I like that you'd put it that way, because studying book two of the Book of the Law in comparison to modern left-hand path and Satanism, it's a little bit like when you're 13 and you go over to your friend's house and you try and show his older brother your new Metallica CD and he's like, ha, ha, little kid. You ever heard about this thing called Black Sabbath?
I guess it's true.
Because if you read left-hand path literature from LaVey to Ford to Aquino, a lot of their ideas about Satan, about Set, the isolate consciousness, it seems like they stole a lot of it from book two and this concept of Hadit. And then they just put like the sexy goth lipstick and vampire teeth on it and repackaged it, essentially.
That's a funny way to put it.
Book two, for me, was definitely the hardest chapter of the Book of the Law to get, like, to understand completely. Even to this day, I don't even know what every line means.
I feel like we're going to have our hands full with three. Two gives us the most to talk about, and arguably it's the most interesting. Like, if you were going to show someone Thelema to begin with, show them book one. But if you want to get into the nitty-gritty philosophy, show them book two. So back to the two primary characters, I found myself explaining this to my mom, like drawing a circle and a point, and she looks at me and she's like, so you're telling me this is it, Luke? These two things? And I'm just like, yes, mom. So to review, Hadit is the point, Nuit is the circle, and they're represented esoterically that way on the Stela of Revealing.
The Stela of Revealing is that funerary tablet that we talked about in previous episodes. Hadit can be seen at the top of the Stela. He's a winged sun disk, and that winged sun disk is known as Bedeti, which was associated with the sun, but more specifically with Horus of Edfu. And Horus of Edfu is the sky god Horus that is associated with the midday sun. And so this particular aspect is related to the height of the sun god Ra in the sky. In his aspect as Horus the Elder, he has the right eye of Ra the sun and the left eye of Thoth the moon. Quite often, heavenly aspects of divinities were portrayed by the symbolic use of falcon wings. So the symbolic use of the wings with the sun in the center as a bright red disc for Hadit, it's accurate having been applied to him in the Stele of Revealing, because the rising of Hadit in union with Nuit is symbolically shown there at the top, and his center also aligns with Nuit's center as she bends to kiss his wings. So this would be Hadit when he rises to be in union with Nuit.
Because as we learned in the last book, they manifest each other. They come as a package deal, which we're going to see that idea reflected in the very first line of book two. Book two begins as thus, Nu, the hiding of Hadit. This contrasts the opening of the first book spoken by Nuit.
Had, the manifestation of Nuit.
This makes the opening lines of their respective books seem a bit like a yin-yang of each other. In its simplest terms, this can be described as the all hides the one. The individual contrasts the many, while the many contain the individual. The manifest form is the clothing of the unmanifest force.
Like holographic universe theory, you have the reality that has currently unfolded or is unfolding, and then you have these kinetic energy or potential energies that are latent, but they're still there. They still comprise the whole of the model of reality.
So Hadit would be the latent, and Nu would be the manifest.
The potential in something, the potential energy versus the actual active force.
Crowley, in his 1912 comment, says,
every individual manifests the whole, and the whole conceals every individual. The soul interprets the universe, and the universe veils the soul. Nature understands herself by becoming self-conscious in her units, and the consciousness loses its sense of separateness by disillusion in her.
Right, so it's the state of consciousness where we feel the oneness with the universe and no separation of things. That's like a Nuit mentality. And then at the very opposite of that is an individual perspective of owning all this stuff and having a special place for every little thing in your little man cave shelf. That's like Hadid's mentality. But together, they create everything.
The idea of a man cave might sound like a joke in this context, but it's actually not. It's an important concept that relates to Hadid and his nature. Line 2 says,
"Come, all ye, and learn the secret that hath not yet been revealed. I, Hadid, am the complement of Nu, my bride. I am not extended, and Kabs is the name of my house."
So Hadid is secret and unrevealed. Hadid is also nothingness in extension. The Kabs is his house. Here exists an esoteric, prototypical form, a strong parallel to the concept of the black flame in left-hand path practices. This is where the idea of the man cave comes up.
Mm-hmm, yep.
In Crowley's 1912 comment, Kabs, quote, "a star is a unit of Nuit, and therefore Nuit herself. This doctrine is enormously difficult of apprehension, even after many years of study. Hadid is the core of every star. He is thus the impersonal identity within the individual of every man and every woman. He is, quote, not extended, that is, without condition of any sort of the metaphysical sense."
So the concept, and this is cool because in astrology, the sun sign, which is a circle with a dot in the middle, which is usually attributed to masculine principle, is the symbol of your sun sign is your core personality or your ego. And then this line is actually, in Crowley's comment, is inferring that while you have an individual perspective and an individual ego, you are part of Nuit, which is the universe as a whole. Her body is comprised of every core of every star in the universe. So when you zoom out in the macro perspective, it becomes female as a collective.
That's why the first line is Nu, the hiding of Hadid.
Yeah, she's a veil upon all individual consciousnesses that are existing at this one point in time.
It says, "I am not extended," but he is the extension of Nuit. He's not extended. He is the extension.
You know how Nu is related to nothing and the concept of not? Likewise, mm-hmm. The ego is groundless, baseless. It also is not. So when Hadid says, "I am not extended," this is like that hip hop lyric where he's saying, I am nothingness in extension.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's like a play on words almost. Like you say you're the negative, but the goddess of the universe is the negative. So you're saying you're wholesome, you're in union with the universe when you say that.
If you're familiar with Kabbalistic stuff, you could say that Nuit and Hadid are like Ain and Ain Sof. Would be Ain and Ain Sof when in union, and Hadid when manifest would be Kether.
According to Oliver St. John, in The Scarlet Woman or Soul in the Underworld, he says, "Hadid, the serpent of knowledge, is the ubiquitous metaphysical point of consciousness within the circle of the absolute, and is simultaneously everywhere. The Kab star is the fivefold window or gateway of consciousness that projects the visible world or material universe through the five senses in man. Hadid is then the invisible yet active light, the mysterious source behind it. Nuit, the polar complement of Hadid, the circle that encompasses all, can be conceived as zero. The appearance of Nuit via the mysterious agency of Hadid may be likened to the Ku, the magical spirit body formed by the emanation of the Kabs. The five radials of the Kab star are the five senses in man, which are a window to the universe. The visible universe, however, can only act as a mirror of man and his fivefold perception." So what does this mean? This describes the soul is a house with five windows. Our ego self is what is seen outside the windows and our experience of them. In the Book of the Law, Nuit refers to each vista as a set of space marks, and one set correspond to our birth chart. The thing experiencing this view out the windows is Hadid. This is the fire of the soul whose line of sight radiates from these windows. Hadid is the complement to his bride Nu, which is the continuous nature of existence outside of the windows and their infinite multitude of possible configurations. Line 3. "In the sphere, I am everywhere the center, and she, the circumference, is nowhere found." Crowley in the D comment, 1923, explains, "Hadid is any point that may be chosen. He is thus in all places alike, while she, being all that may be, hath no limit and cannot be numbered."
So just a reference back to the chapter one episode of the Book of the Law, we were previously talking about how every individual conscious perspective sees itself as the center. Each expression of this consciousness manifests as its own center of the universe, so to speak. That's because it cannot see beyond what it can perceive. So since every point of consciousness is Hadith, we can acknowledge that these expressions of consciousness or life are everywhere the center, just as all matter that is manifest is only beholden to its perception through its own experiences. This is an exceptionally vast concept from the microcosmic levels to the macrocosmic levels. And Nuit even tells us every man and every woman is a star, right? And every star is its own center.
This reminds me a lot of the limits of the observable universe, how you can only see a total of 93 billion light years in either direction until you start to look at the center of the universe, which is everywhere around you and the place where you are now.
Yeah, I think that's so cool.
And how Einstein was brewing up relativity at this point, and there's no way to remove the observer in relativity. That becomes one of the most important points of physics, is the idea of this unremovable observer. And there not being a universal one. There is no universal observer. Hadith is everywhere the center. This is a fact of science.
Line 4 says, "Yet she shall be known, and I never." I think this is a lot like him saying, because we're talking about knowledge and what you know here, is that if you're not like a real divine masculine energy type, you're going to fall for my bride. But like, if you really know what's up, you know, you'll be on, you know, that Hadith consciousness level of what you really know is worth your time and your energy, especially in terms of what you're doing magically. That's how I interpreted it when I first read it. So his new comment, Crowley wrote in 1921, "Hadith possesses the power to know, Nuit that of being known. Hadith is hidden in Nuit and knows her, she being an object of knowledge, but he is not knowable, for he is merely that part of her which she formulates in order that she may be known."
I personally refer to the reference of knowledge being a form of union with something. And we know that because Hadith is a manifestation of Nuit, in coming to know Hadith, you are in actuality coming to know Nuit manifest. And Hadith is collectively in every expression and aspect unknowable, for he is the expression and motion of the union and knowing of Nuit. So she shall be known, and I, as a separate individuality or consciousness, when only seen as an ego, never. Like, to come to know Hadith, you actually come to know Nuit.
Also, it's Hadith that does the knowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like the ultimate consciousness that is living inside the depths of your unconsciousness. Like, somewhere in that darkness is like some badass dude named Hadith inside of all of us.
It's really not that much different from the concept of the Buddha mind.
Nuit shall be known, and Hadith is the knower.
When you put them together.
That's book 3, but we'll get there.
Sometimes when a mommy and a daddy love each other very much, that's where babies come from.
Oh, woo woo.
When they kiss, like in Star Wars.
They kiss with their private parts.
No.
With their butts? Ew.
Butt babies.
There's no private parts in Star Wars. They make babies by kissing.
Yeah, they just have to kiss. Babies.
That's why Rey is pregnant.
I am not a family-friendly corgi.
This is arguably the most interesting part. Line 5. "Behold, the rituals of the old time are black. Let the evil ones be cast away. Let the good ones be purged by the prophet. Then shall this knowledge go aright."
I love this line, first of all, because aright should be a normal vocabulary. We always say awry, or, you know, it goes wrong. I like the word aright quite a bit.
Well, it's like the opposite of awry.
Yeah.
Right?
And I never knew it had an opposite word. This is beautiful. Like, let's make things go aright.
The only time I've ever heard in conversation the word aright be used and have it not be weird is in sailing.
Oh, interesting.
Like in correcting your course.
And you're sailing on the waters of, you know, waters feminine, like the universe.
The waters of noon.
Waters yep. of Vietnam.
Never get out of the boat. Sit up, take a sip of coffee, because This is the point in the story where multiple epic threads of thought converge, and the transcendental wool covering our collective eyes begins to unravel, bringing the bigger picture into focus. If you walk away from The Whole Rabbit with anything, I hope it's a collection of happy moments and this specific information. For starters, there is a prolific and popular mythology surrounding the idea of the Illuminati, an elite class of global rulers possessed of spiritual knowledge which enables them to dominate the affairs of humankind. According to popular myth, usually for evil. Whether it's a quick Google image search or natural rushing of mental pictures through the mind's eye, an obvious grouping of symbols related to this hypothetical organization probably include the eye in the pyramid, or triangle, the Masonic G, black cubes, the planet Saturn, the god Saturn, hexagrams, skulls, bones, thrones, blackness, death. In the most popular episode we've ever done, the Black Cross of Saturn, we explain exactly how these symbols relate to one another. And there's a damn good reason. One reason is that they make up the symbolic DNA of the world's most successful religions and their powerful mysteries. To the ancient Hebrews, we have the concept of rest, or Shabbat, which coincides with the idea of God resting in the center of his perfected work on the seventh day. Because Saturn is the sixth planet, it corresponds to the perfected work and why God is resting there. For this reason, Saturn was given the name Shabbatai, the root word Shavat, meaning both rest, and the number seven. Likewise, if God was resting inside or on top of the six-sided cube of the world to the Hebrews, to the Christians, he was blossoming from its unfolding into the crucifix. In Islam, there's the centrality of the black cube of the Kaaba, which each Muslim is called to pray towards and encircle seven times, if able. The importance of Saturn and Cronus to Greek and Roman mythology can hardly be overstated, and once you consider where both they and the Hebrews got it from, a really big puzzle piece falls into place that explains exactly what's going on in this particular line and its associated commentaries. In ancient Egypt, the word for both line and seven was Sabah. Both of these words were related to completion and rest because the funerary bier of the dying and resurrected vegetation god Osiris was resting upon it. He's the first mummy! The whole thing comes from him. Osiris's hieroglyph even includes a throne and an eye, which would later become the planetary symbol of Saturn and corresponds neatly with the eye in the triangle, and by extension, the Masonic G or even the seven. So whether you like it or not, nearly every spiritual model or religion or philosophy you've ever been exposed to owes a spectacularly large portion of its deeper mysteries and symbolism to this one Osirian archetype. Even Easter, why the bunny eggs? Osiris. Satanism, why the enthroned father goat in the underworld? Osiris. Why does Ice-T and Ice Cube have the name they have? Osiris. As excited as I can sound talking about this, Crowley is candidly nonchalant and even seems as if he expects his audience to have taken this hugely obscured network of facts for granted because, after all, it pertains directly to the context under which he's beginning this new spiritual age, which will be ruled over not by Osiris, but by his child, Horus. To put it in modern terms, Aleister Crowley believed his new religion of Thelema existed to unzip and install a patch update to the entire spiritual matrix of humanity, which would prepare it for a futuristic era of limitless potential in which each person was equally sacred and endowed with the right to live according to their life's true purpose, free from molestation and coercion of the New World Order powers. Ironically, these old world powers are what conspiracy theorists seem to have eaten the propaganda for when they erroneously call it the New World Order. It was Crowley who wanted a New World Order. The black cube of Saturn stuff is the Old World Order, and Crowley is quite emphatic here referring to it as Osirian and the Aeon of the Dying God. To quote
Crowley. Well said.
Sorry.
Well said, man.
Thank you.
We mentioned previously, I think, that the age of Osiris turns into the Aeon of Horus.
That is what is being announced here. That? Yeah.
Yeah.
Crowley comments on this specifically. The old time is the Aeon of the dying god. Some of his rituals are founded on an utterly false metaphysic cosmogony, but others are based on truth. We mend these and end those. This knowledge is the initiated wisdom of the Aeon of Horus. What then may we understand by this verse with the capital K for knowledge? What is it? And what shall it go aright? The key is in the word go. It cannot be, as we have seen above. It is the fundamental error of the Black Brothers in their policy of resisting all change to try to maintain it as a fixed and an absolute. Crowley continues. Now, the quote, rituals of the old time are no longer valid vehicles. Knowledge cannot go aright until they are adapted to the formula of the new aeon. Their defects are due principally to two radical errors. One, the universe was conceived as possessing a fixed center, or summit, an absolute standard to which all things might be referred. A unity, or God. Mystics were angry and bewildered often enough when attaining to union with God. They found him equally in all. This led to making a difference between one thing and another, so as the ideas of superiority, sin, etc., ending by absurdities of all kinds, alike in theology, ethics, and science.
Same with being incarnate. Like, your ego is your own perspective. It's the movie playing in your own eyeballs and your brain. And to say, oh, that's the center of the universe because I'm alive and I experienced this, that's a fallacy, because any perspective can be the center of the universe, no matter where you're looking from.
And we explored how dangerous that center of the universe summit perspective crap is, because it manifested so much of the evil of World War II. Was the whole mental conundrum about this looking for a center and a perfect and a all this crap, which...
And we ascribe values to things as, you know, this mm-hmm. is lesser and this is greater.
Yeah, like when Copernicus disproved this Earth-centric system.
Yeah.
And there was upheaval. You know, people did not want to believe that. They did not want to believe that this planet or this plane of materialism was the center of the universe. You know, but you have to accept that if somebody is looking from a different perspective, there's no such thing as the center. Only when you're experiencing it is there a center at all.
The next problem, he says, with the old aeon thinking is the absolute antithesis between the pair of opposites. This is really a corollary of, one, there was an imaginary absolute evil, but each man will postulate an absolute God, defined him unconsciously in terms of a Freudian phantasm by his own wish-fulfillment machinery. Thus, God and evil were really expressions of personal prejudice. A man who bowed humbly to the authority of the Pope or the Bible or the Oracle of Apollo or of the tribal medicine man, none of the less expressed truly of his own wish to abdicate responsibility.
Absolutely.
In the light of this book, we know that the center is everywhere, the circumference nowhere, that every man and every woman is a star, a Kabs, the name of the house of Hadith, the word of sin is restriction. To us, then, evil is a relative term. It is that which hinders one from fulfilling his true will.
That's so nice. For example, the idea of you meet people that are like, oh, it's a rainy day, it's thunderstorming outside, it's a gross day outside. They attribute rain and gloominess to bad, but if you flip it on the other side, you realize, okay, well, I'm raising a garden personally. Every time it rains, I get a free watering and my plants come back even bigger the next day. You know, it's not good or bad. It's just part of being alive.
It's calling out the attributes as being relative to the individual and the experience, right?
You know, when you're looking out on the universe from your own perspective, your ego or the way that you process information, it's like you're looking through a pane of glass that's distorted according to how you were raised or how you were conditioned to respond to certain stimuli.
To me, it says like designated absolutes is absurdity.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's good for the lion is evil for the antelope.
Yeah.
Well, he's saying it's like physics. There's no absolute observer, so there's no absolute evil or absolute good. Further, he says, the Osirian rituals inculcating self-sacrifice to an abstract ideal, mutilation to appease an ex-cathedra morality, fidelity to an a priori formula, etc., teach false and futile methods of acquiring false knowledge. They must be cast away or purged. The schools of initiation must be reformed. Eshelman goes on later to comment. Note that black cannot mean evil, since all the old rituals are, quote, black, but some are good and some are evil. Perhaps black simply means Osirian, since Osiris is a, quote, black god. In any case, the wording suggests that they are incapable of reflecting light to their witnesses.
I think it doesn't just call out the origin as being Osirian, but I think it also, by using the term black, is referring specifically to Kemet, to the word for ancient Egypt, which means black land. And also that the colors are black to the blind as well. So the old rituals being black might also be referring to this.
It's saying that since these old rituals are of ours anyway, we're going to fix them for you. It can mean both those things.
Yeah. I've always liked the interpretation that it's like Hemet, which refers to black land. But to me, this line reads more like that the magic of the old times was for a different aeon, a different age, so different things were acceptable. But in this new aeon, it's like we don't need to do that stuff anymore, and we probably can consider that evil in terms of the new aeon.
Well, we know that a lot of the Judeo-Christian rituals and belief systems and many other religions as well are just like remixes upon remixes, which you could trace back to the Osirian myth. And I think it's kind of making reference to that as well and saying like, yes, these rituals are from there. And part of it too is like, you don't just absolutely leave it behind because the child of the new aeon is still of the father, so to speak, but it can go aright and correct it. You can correct your course.
It also is saying like, you wonder why you've noticed an active ingredient in almost every magic you've tried. It's because this is where the active ingredient came from. And you've been cutting it and watering it down ever since. And we're going to fix it, get it back to its full purity.
Yeah, and we don't have to have this Osirian dying god anymore because we are moving into the new aeon of the eternal, the aeon of Horus, the eternal god.
This is super important because even if you don't believe in Crowley's patch update, you could probably see the world is due for one. The old religions, patriarchy, the monetary system, gender identity, racial identity, national identity are all in a state of radical overhaul. It's my heartfelt belief and understanding that the quote, black brothers or the elites who wish to resist this patch update know that the children of humanity will be magnetically attracted by their birthright to change things and will be working furiously as a matter of their continued survival to give us release of these sincerely powerful and needed transformative energies into channels they control and can redirect and shut down at their will.
Line 6 reads, I am the flame that burns in every heart of man, and in the core of every star. I am life, and the giver of life, yet therefore is the knowledge of me the knowledge of death.
Crowley's old comment reads, Hadith is the ego or Atman in everything, but of course, a loftier and more secret thing than anything understood by the Hindus, and of course, the distinction between ego and ego is illusion. Hence, Hadith, who is life of all that is, if known, becomes the death of that individuality.
Yeah, I think Duquette puts it, I think it's said in even some rituals, like dissolving into each other, Hadith and Nuit do.
Crowley's new comment reads, It follows that, as Hadith can never be known, there is no death. The death of the individual is his awakening to the impersonal immortality of Hadith. This applies less to physical death than to the crossing of the abyss. One may attain to be aware that one is but a particular child of the play of Hadith Nuit. One's personality is then perceived as being a disguise. It is not only not a living thing, as one had thought, but a mere symbol without substance, incapable of life. It is the conventional form of a certain cluster of thoughts, themselves the partial and hieroglyphic symbols of an ego. The conscious and sensible man, quote unquote, is to his self just what the printed letters on this page are to me to have caused them to manifest in color and form. They are arbitrary devices for conveying my thought. I could use French or Greek just as well. Nor is this thought here conveyed more than one ray of my orb, and even that whole orb is but the garment of me. The analogy is precise, therefore, when one becomes the knower. It involves the death of all sense of the ego. One perceives one's personality precisely as I now do these printed letters. And they are forgotten, just as absorbed in my thought. The trained automatism of my mind and the body expressed that thought in writing without attention on my part, still less with identification of the extremes involved in the process. He's saying your incarnations are groundless, baseless.
When Hadith says, I am the flame that burns in every heart of man and in the core of every star, for me, it really reminds me a lot of Sekhem in Egypt. It was understood that all the light of the stars was related to Sekhem, which is the power or force of divine nature. And we spoke before about how in the first chapter, Nuit says that every man and woman is a star. And we also spoke about how that relates to the house of Horus and in turn, the house of the Pharaoh. So Hadith being the divine masculine principle is also related to the masculine gods Ptah, Amun, Ra, Horus, and Osiris. Some of the epithets for Osiris includes the great Sekhem, or foremost of powers. I think I mentioned this before, but it brings us back to what Hadith can be representative of. He's the Sekhem, the individual expressive sparks of consciousness, the flame that burns in every heart of man and in the core of every star. He's the motion, the active force, or the Sekhem inherent in the universe.
It really reminds me of the fugitive pygmy from Dark Souls, the human who finds the first flame inside the darkness under the world.
Line 7 reads, I am the magician and the exorcist. I am the axle of the wheel and the cube in the circle. Come unto me is a foolish word, for it is I that go. Crowley's old comment reads, Hadid is both the maker of illusion and its destroyer. For though his interplay with Nuit results in the production of the finite, yet his withdrawing into himself is the destruction thereof. The axle of the wheel, another way of saying that he is the core of things. From a magical perspective, it's saying that Hadid is the thing which draws something into existence, and also it's the thing that banishes it and takes it away.
This is like what we were saying earlier, that Hadid is like motion, for it is I that go. It's the expression, the manifest.
And it makes sense that this is a masculine principle. It seems like Hadid seems to be a masculine protrusion, I guess, of the feminine universe.
In China, it would be the yang energy, the masculine, the rising, the motion.
The action, you know, the not only fighting, but I say like, you know, harvesting crops, planting crops, doing action to reap a benefit from it or to manipulate your surroundings. You must do an action. Like if I see food over there, I'm going to have to actually walk over there and pick it up. You have to do action in order to continue living.
Like he's like a Giga Chad and he can move his house around. Like you don't come over to his house ever. Like he brings his house to you every single time for all eternity.
But also action has an end and it's definite. It's not infinite like the feminine Nuit. Hadid is more of a punctuation or a utilitarian movement within that aspect of the feminine.
To the fools, to the fools he is.
Yeah, I would say that would be our default perception of yes. Hadid.
Line 8 reads, who worship Heru Pakrath have worshipped me ill, for I am the worshipper.
Here Hadid identifies as Heru Pakrath, which is an Egyptian name for Horus the Child, which the Greco-Romans knew as the child Harpocrates. What's so important about this kid? Well, first of all, he's the one who's destined to grow up, overthrow his tyrannical uncle Set, who killed his father Osiris, take back the throne, and rule Upper and Lower Egypt as divine ruler and king. After all, Osiris is the black god mentioned just 3 lines ago, and is the one identified as the ruler of the old age, so it only makes sense his child would be destined to one day become king. But first, he has to grow up. Until then, Horus the child is busy being silent, nestled in his mother Isis's armpit, suckling away until he's grown and ready to take on his big bad uncle Set.
Bro, why does this remind me of Hamlet?
Well,
because it is Hamlet.
Well, yeah, Shakespeare was alive during the time of John Dee.
They were all sucking each other's dicks, swapping wives.
Probably.
I mean, whatever works for them, they're freaking stage performer writers and shit.
Thespians.
Defeat armies with their brains instead of their cocks.
Thespians. You know how they are.
Thespians.
Hey, it's Pride Month. Hey, Crowley, man. He was, you know.
Biggest thespian of them all.
He was the beast. He was the beast, man.
He was a prop on the stage. He wasn't even an actor.
But why is it bad to worship Harpocrates? Why is it bad to worship Harpocrates? Why? He's such a cute child. To answer this question, we might try asking Kathleen Kennedy, who arguably, quote, ruined the Star Wars sequels to ruminate on this exact point to the chagrin of Luke Skywalker fans everywhere.
I love where this is going.
The operative idea being that we are called to become or embody Harpocrates in silent ecstasy of Isis, not worship Horus Skywalker externally as a symbol of perfection. This is really not that much different from Rinzai Zen. If you see the Buddha on the path, kill him. The spoken Tao is not the real Tao. It's a very similar idea.
Totally.
Is it the veil?
It's saying you don't worship the Buddha. You attain to Buddha mind yourself.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you become.
Okay. It's an example. It's not something to be admonished.
Not or separate. Or like
desired, you know.
Don't worship separate. Christ. Be Christ.
Yeah.
This line reiterates the idea that Hadid is the true kernel of self, and that this true kernel of self is to be embodied at the expense of one's personal ego, rather than worshipped as an external symbol by the ego. Who are you, Ray, from nowhere? but ye are not so chosen. It's this concept that the ego self is not the core self, and that to know the core self is to die to the ego self and have the ego self be burnt up entirely.
But like we were talking about in the Nuit episode, where when she says, but ye are not so chosen, it's like, you're not chosen, you're realized. You realize it.
Or it becomes manifest through your hands, or through your action.
Or you, personality, are not chosen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Crowley says, it's bad magic to admit that one is other than one's innermost self. One should plunge passionately into every possible experience. By doing so, one is purged of those personal prejudices, which we took so stupidly for ourselves, though they prevented us from realizing our true wills and from knowing our names and our natures. The aspirant must well understand that it is no paradox to say that the annihilation of the ego in the abyss is the condition of emancipating the true self and exalting it to unimaginable heights. He's just Tyler Durden right now. I don't know. He's just, you have to hit bottom.
If you read this, like if you see the actual way that this line is written, you'll notice that there's an unusual placement of the semicolon. That says quite a bit, I think. It's the semicolon exists right before the word ill. And because of the connection of the divine child and the divine father or masculine, it's also implied that to worship Harpocrates, you also worship him. Horus the child has that divine right. Horus the child has that divine right to the throne because of his father Osiris. He then continues the sentence after that semicolon to explain why that does ill. Worshipping Harpocrates is likewise worshipping Hadid, but then the latter half of the sentence expresses exactly what Luke said about not simply worshipping, but rather becoming and being. The part which says, for I am the worshiper, I think that also has to do with Hadid being expression, motion, and the like.
So in this context, does that have anything to do with being not as good or sick or decrepit or disabled in some way?
Like Harpocrates is there suckling in complete rapture of Isis, and you got all these people worshiping the baby, and then the baby speaks and he's like, y'all are missing out. Y'all should be worshiping the titty like I am. You should be like me. You guys are doing yourself a disservice.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Don't look to the finger that's pointing to the moon. Look at the moon. Line number 9 says, remember all ye that existence is pure joy, that all the sorrows are but as shadows. They pass and are done, but there is that which remains. So when we left Horus the child, he was quietly suckling at his mother Isis's teat. In fact, in the Hermetic tradition, when one takes the sign of Harpocrates, or sometimes as it's known, the sign of silence, one stands feet together, left finger touching the lip innocently like a child. Purists will be quick to point out this gesture is not the child shushing, but indicating innocence and wordless receptivity. Horus, like any toddler, self-soothes by sucking his finger when his mother's nipple, the source of his nourishment and drunkenness, is unavailable. To put it bluntly, the sign of silence in the vision of Harpocrates represents the wordless, oceanic bliss, and egoless union with our mother, who in the extended metaphor is existence itself.
That's kind of like when you're wondering something and you put your finger upon your chin right under your lip, or you put it on your lip like as if you're pondering something.
You're shushing somebody.
No, well, you're not. But you're not, though. You're thinking and you're trying to receive something.
Well, if you were hungry and you didn't have the words to express that you were hungry, the way that your hands would move would be like you would have an open hand for receptivity, and you would point to where you're receptive for it, which is your mouth.
Exactly. And that's what that baby thing is. When you pull your lower lip, your palm is open, your fingers are extended as if to receive, and you seem lost or you need some nourishment. At the same time, like when Malachor was saying, the shushing motion is usually a fist shape where you curl your fingers in upon each other. You're closed off from receiving anything, and you're putting a finger on top of your lips as if to say, don't speak, don't create, don't make anything, don't do any action.
So as the meme has continued like onward and onward through time, it is represented sometimes as a shush, but I'm just explaining from the purist perspective. Have you seen the baby doing that weird like Fu Manchu? Well, like, that's what it's talking about.
On the chin.
Well, if you look at the first part of this line, he says, remember all ye that existence is pure joy. That's kind of like what Hadid was saying, is that like, it's my ecstasy. Like that's the sign that everything's good. Harpocrates would be in bliss here and giving his mom joy at the same time, almost just being a child. And there's like a silence to that serenity that the sign represents.
Like a pause or a reflection.
Yes, it's wordless.
When you're receiving into your mouth, you're also not usually making a whole lot of sound. You're receiving, right?
You're busy.
You're feeding.
Crowley has a hip-hop style punchline regarding this wisdom specifically, and it comes out during his confessions when he states, curved smile visible even from beyond the veil of time. I have never grown out of the infantile belief that the universe was made for me to suck.
Suck.
I'd like to hear someone include that into a hip-hop song.
It has a double meaning, but he can be a funny guy sometimes. So this lyric about infantile sucking sounds even more rap punchline-like when we consider that Crowley himself actually had to grow into the wisdom that he penned down in Book 2 and struggled with how it conflicted with his personal ontological assumptions that he had adopted from Buddhism. Quote, mine angel I was watched me as I wrote down his words, saw with rage that I withstood his spirit, for in my deepest conscious mind I held most firm the first noble truth proclaimed by Gautama Buddha. Everything is sorrow! And on this thought I had built up all my spirit and mind for many days. The word of I was, therefore, stuck in my heart of the most earnest thought, and I hated the hand and the pen which wrote against my will in service to his, for he was the force to subdue me, to make me obey him, that his word might be written and go forth unto men to utter the new law.
Question.
Yes.
The word of Iowa, is that anything to do with ayahuasca?
I don't think we gave people a little breakdown of terminology yet. Did we?
It sounds very similar.
We talked about Iwas a little bit in the episode one, but in short, it's Crowley's holy guardian angel, and he's also relating it to the priest Ankhna Khonsu, who was a Theban priest that worshipped Mentu. So there's some corollary between those two things, but he does refer to Iwas later in his career, more in alignment with it being his holy guardian angel.
Mm.
Yeah, his higher consciousness.
It's interesting, too, that when people take ayahuasca, they report a higher dimensional feminine entity that is guiding them.
I like how ayahuas sounds a little bit like I was.
Yeah.
Like the death of his ego. I was.
Yeah.
There's also evidence that the name of God is I am. So the sun, the sun circle we were talking about, the action, you know, I am that I am and I was. So
yes.
There's still a complementary relationship between these words, and they're from different cultures. They're from completely different cultures.
But you see how it shows an evolution.
It does.
While writing the Book of the Law in 1912, Crowley was admittedly still under the sway of the old Aeon, a self-proclaimed master of its esoteric catalog, and still firmly subscribed to its philosophies, which just moments ago were called in part evil and in part need of purging because they were of the old ways, which were, quote, black, a reference to Osiris. In some sense, this also made Crowley, quote, black. Yet still, he was the one who had to bear up this child to the world, not unlike the mythology of ancient Egypt. His shadow aspect carried the potential to kill this child before it ever had the chance to avenge the world. And who knows? Maybe it did. It's important to remember that Set, the Dark One who wishes to kill the child Horus after successfully murdering Daddy Osiris, is the uncle to the former and brother of the latter. There is poetic reasoning behind this, which George Lucas borrowed for the scene where Obi-Wan explains to Luke that Darth Vader or Set killed his father, Anakin Skywalker. Spoiler! Darth Vader is also Anakin Skywalker, and by extension, Luke Skywalker's father! If you didn't know that, I'm sorry. And while some people will always think bringing up Star Wars is silly, I think the metaphoric similarity is there on purpose and is a sincere representation of our real world, no matter how ironically we are told it is happening a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Just last week, we saw how a few strokes of Master Therion's pen still hold the potential to cut his child, A New Hope, clearly in half if some rapid distance is not quickly made and older sources of wisdom sought to bolster it. Another example of a popular retelling of the myth of Osiris, Set, and Horus can be found in the classic Disney animation Lion King, where James Earl Jones once again voices Osiris. In Lion King, this is Mufasa, which in the Monzato language means king. Like Osiris, Mufasa teaches the wisdom about the great circle of life and how death leads to new life, even invoking the greenness of the grass in his example. Simba, which means lion or strength, wishes to be crowned in conquering as a child, but must flee from the shadow aspect of his father, Scar, following his father's death, only to find that the world, even beyond where the light touches, is pure joy, or Hakuna Matata, if he only surrenders his ego identity, a king though he may be. He learns this so clearly, in fact, that he refuses to accept his ego identity, even if it means getting exclusive breeding rights with every female lion on Pride Rock. Maybe J.R. Bob Dobbs was right about original Slack after all. Either way, Thoth, or Rafiki, spits in Horus's eye and he regains the sight that Scar, or Set, took from him. Simba realizes that Osiris is not dead and lives in the sky as the stars, that death is an illusion, and that he has no right but to do as he will. Defeat Set, the principle of death inherited from his father, and initiate a new era ruled by the sun. The end. So yeah, Star Wars and Lion King are Thelema for kids.
That was awesome.
I'm going to say something about Lion King, but you know, I'm a furry and everyday behavior for me.
Basically, line 9 is Hakuna Matata, right?
Line 9?
Yeah. Line 9 is Hakuna Matata. That's
in summary, or, you know, use the force, Luke, when he's trying to shoot the torpedo in with the freaking, you know, AI-assisted targeting thing. And Obi-Wan's just like, use the force, you know, just let go with the flow. But Hakuna Matata is the same.
The circle of life, Hakuna Matata.
Let it rip.
That's true. So the next two lines kind of do suggest some more Hakuna Matata energy on Crowley's behalf. Line 10 reads, "O prophet, thou hast ill will to learn this writing." So in Crowley's comments that he wrote later, he pretty much said Hadith forced him to write this stuff, and that Crowley was a little upset about it because he couldn't really do anything about it. He would later use this experience to transcend sorrow, or like the part of magic that sucks and like, why am I even doing this? I think that's what he's referring to in terms of sorrow, and that like this experience he had to go and do this thing he didn't feel right doing in order to get the job done. So later he really changes his mind about it all.
This line kind of reminds me of how a lot of monasteries will be like, well, why do you want to be here? What are you looking to learn? And if you say like, oh, I want to become a better person, I want to be more spiritual, and they're like, for what? Why for? For self-attainment? That's self. Like, they kind of throw it right in your face. You have ill will to learn this.
Yeah.
I think by referencing will in this and saying ill will, there's also referencing like true will. And this is a deviation from true will because he wants. That's just a pure desire for attainment. That's not based in true will. That, like, he hasn't figured out that yet.
And we'll, yeah, and I'm saying that there's a difference between those two things,
which we'll probably get into, not even in the extended show, in the next episode. It goes back to this point and explains it quite vigorously in a way that's helpful to using magic, no matter what belief system you're a part of. So, line 11. I see thee hate the hand and the pen, but I am stronger.
In Crowley's comments later, straight up saying Hadith was stronger than me and compelled him to write the Book of the Law with his body, with his own body.
Oh, no, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just writing this book. Oh, I can't stop.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hadith is like, that is your true self, right? This is your true self. Your true self is ultimately stronger. And if you're in conversation with your true self is stronger.
Sounds like Adam Smith to me.
I have a theory, and I'm going to share it here at the end of the free show. I think, because we've said before that it was probably his wife, Rose Edith Kelly, doing the speaking, Crowley was there actually with the pen, just gritting his teeth because he knew he had to write what she was saying. And so, and this is where the sex magic comes in. The thing that he wants to blame this experience on him initiating it sexually with her. Like, he blasted his seed into her butt. And now he's like, oh my God, this is my seed coming out of her mouth and I have to write it down. And so I honestly think that he tried to kind of like flip things and reverse things when he did it with Neuberg because of this.
That's nasty.
When he did Vision in the Voice. But now I'm like in way over my depth and I can't be certain, but I think it might be the case. Like, he's like, you know what? I'm going to be the one to get it in the butt next time. And then I'll have the power.
He wishes.
So I think if you look at these first 11 lines and you line them up with the first 11 Sephirot on the Tree of Life, there are some very interesting overlaps. One would be associated with Kether, two would be Hakma. And if you look at the associations of each line, you can begin to see how they line up. And it's pretty interesting, I think. So go ahead and do that yourself. It will probably bear out a lot of things that we don't even have time to talk about in the free section of the show or the extended section of the show, because we're going to talk about line 12 through 22. And if you'd like to hear that section, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your donation of just $5 will get you access to all our extended episodes, a 5x5 vinyl sticker for cover art, and access to our Discord server, where you can talk about this stuff with us anytime, day or night, because we talk on our phones even when we're sleeping, because we all are sleepwalkers that have somnambulism, and we're zombies. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.